Hi, welcome to Imperfect Creators. If you're new here, I'm Mike, and this podcast is my excuse to talk to people who have found a way to do what they love and do work that is meaningful to them and learn more about their personal story and their life and their work, and hopefully share learnings from their life with you. In today's episode, I'm talking with Dr. Rod Berger. It's hard to summarize Rod in one sentence. He's an author, a psychologist, a lecturer. He's interviewed over 4,000 people. He's done refugee work. He's met everyone from Magic Johnson to the Pope. And he's also just published his first book, The Narrative Edge. So we talk all about that and his life in general, and his life philosophy, and how that's led him to live a life with so many different achievements and so many different stories to tell, and how storytelling kind of connects everything. I left this conversation feeling very inspired, perhaps a little bit more motivated to say yes to more opportunities that come up in life. And I hope you will too. So with that said, let's go on with the show. Rod, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike. I really appreciate being on.
I had some trouble trying to find a good way in here because you've done so many things, to be honest. Like psychology, lecturing, refugee work, interviewing over 4,000 people, writing a book, storytelling. I'm wondering, like, what is the narrative thread that links all of this stuff together?
Well, that's a very good question, Mike, and one that I think I probably wrestle with myself more times than not. Here's what I would say, and this is probably inspired maybe by what we were talking about off air, which is, you know, people have asked me in the past, you know, my career path and how did I decide what I wanted to do? And for whatever reason, now this is timely for when I graduated high school and sort of the age that I was, but I've always fashioned myself as having a career that is very sort of Forrest Gump-like. And what's fascinating is that having that career, and I'm in my late 40s now, growing up, that was not in vogue at all, right? We were still a part of this world where there was a hierarchy. This is the path that you take. Today's young people, they are living much more and celebrating a Forrest Gump existence. They don't have to do whatever parents did or their aunts and uncles or their community is known for. They didn't have to do any of that. So for me, I think the thread has been to always say yes, even when I wasn't sure what I was saying yes to.
Was that an intentional decision at some point in your life that I'm always going to say yes when opportunities pop up?
I think it was. I think it's born from a degree of anxiety. I think that's just. I mean, we all have it. We can't exonerate ourselves from the sense of anxiety as human beings. But you know, I had a few things happen to me growing up and just as a young adult where I took a flyer on something or I opened an email. Or I pushed myself to introduce myself to somebody, you know, at an event. And oh my goodness, it turned into something I would have never thought. And so when that happens, and if you're aware of it, you say to yourself, you know what? I don't normally maybe do work over the weekend or check a random email on a Sunday night that is asking me if I'd like to go to Senegal. But I'm going to do it. And wow, I opened it. I thought it was going to be spam and it was not at all. And it was that opening of that email that, if anything, birthed my book. I would say that that is potentially the moment in time was when I opened an email that I just randomly opened that I bet it was a 50-50 if it went to spam and it didn't. And I just thought, why do I? You know, it was from a well-known publicist. And I thought, I've heard that name, but that person doesn't know me. And I opened it and it was a real email. And so, you know, you just sort of when you do that over time, it's like you always want to open that email. Even if it's not an email, right? If it's just, that's just sort of the umbrella with which you operate. You just don't know, right? You take a flyer. And more times than not, taking that flyer has worked for me. There have been plenty of times where it has not, and it's gone off the rails a bit. And hopefully I've learned lessons along the way. But saying yes has absolutely been a part of my ethos.
I was going to ask, how do you know when to actually say yes to that flyer? Like you get that email saying, hey, want to go to Senegal? And it sounds a bit like it's just intuition or it's just a bit like there must be some calculation in your mind that, or like some gut feeling that says, yeah, okay, this is worthwhile giving it a try. Or like, what is that?
So in the beginning, I don't know if I was very discerning. And so maybe there was some dumb luck involved in that or just the stars were aligning and there were some good opportunities. Now, I will say that even there have been plenty of times where I had said yes to something. I'm in the middle of sort of fulfilling whatever that yes had laid out for me to do or participate or to be a part of. And I thought to myself, wow, would I have said yes if I knew what this entailed? So I always try my hardest in those instances to push myself to find a value because I'm pretty stubborn in that each engagement has an opportunity. And it's not about leveraging at all. It's just, I think sometimes we don't talk about ourselves because we fear that we're going to sound egotistical. When actually, if we talked about the things that make us human, that we all share in our stressors or the anxieties or our hopes and dreams, or our accomplishments that we learn from other people and we go, wow, I share that with Mike. I didn't know that. Mike's an ocean away. Yet we connect in a way that feels very familiar to me. And that could then yield opportunities down the road. Now, the other thing, too, is it's not about some immediate gratification, because I've said yes to things that took years to come to fruition. And so I just think there has to be a groundedness that says my story is not completely written yet. And that's okay. And I'm good with that. It's like I remember one of my dear friends he became a very dear friend. His name is Richard Gerver, and he is a speaker out of England. And he had been a former head teacher, which means principal for those in the U.S. And basically the disciple or a disciple of Sir Ken Robinson, really the sort of founding father of TED Talks. And Richard had been speaking on stage, and Sir Ken was backstage waiting to give the sort of the big keynote, right? Years and years ago. And he hears Richard speak and he thinks, this guy has talent. And so he extends basically that metaphorical arm that says, I want to assist you and mentor you. And so they develop this great relationship. And then years later, I interview Ken and spend time with him. And so it's sort of this full circle moment. And all the while, this sort of the TED Talk was in the background, that this is sort of this binding agent. And I live in Tennessee, and this is years ago, but there was, I had been told, now who knows, right? In this world, if we go off a verbal, you know, I don't know what would result from just verbal agreements with people. But there was a thought that I would be giving a TEDx talk in Tennessee around education and all my work in education. And I had gotten basically passed up by the governor. So in the moment, I was disappointed. I thought that was going to be my moment, and it wasn't. And bringing this full circle and putting a bow on it, when I shared that with Richard Gerver, we were talking and he just said, your story isn't ready to be told, right? And that is one of those pivotal moments where I said, wow, I need to hold on to that, because that's like a bookmark in a really good book, right? Where that bookmark is the most valuable thing at that very moment, when you know you need to lay down at night and you don't want to lose your spot in the book. That was a bookmark moment for me. And that really, it went to my notion of yes, and knowing that sometimes things don't work out, and that my story, while imperfect, is perfectly messy. And if I embrace that, years later I will. And years later I did. And I found myself in a refugee camp in Eastern Africa, composing my TEDx talk in a hut, in sweltering heat, and trying to read it audibly and record it and send it to the organizers. For anybody who's done a TEDx talk, you know, just sort of that process. And it was a wonderful moment for me to just think, wow, I've made it to this point. And I would have never thought, I mean, who could have ever imagined that saying yes on a Sunday to Senegal would then years later get me back to Africa in a refugee camp in Eastern Africa, whereby I'm working on a TEDx talk. So I hope you followed my Forrest Gump tale right there. But really, to me, the long and short of it, Mike, is that, you know, saying yes has done me well by the notion. And it's something that if I'm going to fail, I'd rather fail saying yes than succeeding by saying no and just staying with the status quo.
It also sounds like saying yes is a way for you to, I think the phrase you said is defining your story or telling your story. Like saying yes to these opportunities, you have an awareness of this might drastically change my story. Maybe not right now, maybe down the line. But you're saying yes to stuff that is going to positively impact your story, you hope.
Absolutely. I mean, so one of the things I talk about in the book, by the way, my little shameless plug, The Narrative Edge, Authentic Storytelling That Meets the Moment, my publisher is Wiley, is that I'm a big, I love to, maybe this, I don't even know where it originates, to be quite frank, but I love to think about the characters that we play in the stories that we live. And are we playing, are we embodying a character of our own choosing? Are we playing a character that is driven more by circumstance or things that we can't control? Race, ethnicity, gender, all these, right? And so that's a big driver for me, is to think about the role that we play. And if we're not telling our own story, or basically in control, and control can be a variable term, then who is writing your story? And one of the things that I came back to over and over again in writing my book was, you know, I spent almost 2 decades, hence the gray hair. You enjoy it before you get there, Mike. I worked almost 2 decades with Vanderbilt University's business school students. And this was always fascinating to me because these are students that are highly accomplished. Most of them, I don't want to talk in absolutes, but most of them come from some level of resource, still struggle to understand that they control their story because they have been, I'll harken back, and in the book, you can tell that I'm a movie buff. I'll just say that. I give quite a few references, but in one of my top 2 favorites of all time, The Shawshank Redemption, there is a scene where there's an older gentleman that has been in prison for decades, and he finally gets out, and he can't take it, and he takes his own life. And as an audience, you know, as a viewer, you just are so sad to think that this guy finally got out. But they talked about he had been institutionalized. He had been, his story had been laid out for him in a way where his own decision making was not a part of the calculus. And so I would find the same thing in different ways, obviously, with these students, where they basically would walk in with their resumes and hold their resumes sort of on high, right? That they had, you know, we're sort of all speaking the same language. We're all operating under the same currency. And here's where I stand. And I would look at these resumes and think, this is so incredibly boring. This is not Mike, who is of British descent, who moves to Berlin. Like, there's so much more behind your story. And that's why, if I'm a hiring manager, I'm going to engage with you. Or if I'm looking to put together sort of a special group or committee while I'm going to, you know, appoint you to one of those positions. But these young people had been institutionalized that if they just keep on the path that their forefathers or their uncles or whoever in the lineage of accountants or in finance took, that they would be just fine. And yet I always got a sense that they didn't feel like they had a control over their own story. They didn't know how to talk about their own character. Like, well, tell me about who you are, right? It's that notion of positional power, that if I take away your title, how do you communicate your value to me? You know what you have to do? You have to lean into story without any preparation. And by doing so, you're forced to calculate the way you feel, the way you thought and felt during a specific time, which is why you would relay a story, what role you played in that story, right? And so it's really key, I think, that, look, I don't know if we will ever know. This is the character I am in the story that I live, and it's sort of written in stone. I think it's evolving. I think it's like any great movie or book. The character evolves, and if they don't, well, there's a conclusion, right? Typically in drama, it's death. but in life, it can be feeling stuck. It can be feeling as if I need a transition. Used to, we would call it this midlife crisis, but I think that that is on a slide rule. And I think people experience that at almost every sort of stop, you know, during a lifetime where you just think, is this really what I want? Right? Those are those big questions.
Like, it's not just about career value or business value or something like this. It sounds like what you're describing is a core value for you in life is to say yes to opportunities because that enriches life overall. You are experiencing more stuff. You're having more interesting experiences, more interesting stories. You're becoming a more enriched person. It's not just about, I stay in my lane. I decide, we were talking about this before the interview, like at 18, I decide I'm going to be a lawyer, and then I go and go to law school, and then I work in law until I retire, and that's it. It's like actually just staying flexible and open to anything that comes your way and being open to it.
Yeah, because you don't know where your passion lies and sort of where, in what environments your brain is going to light up, right? And you say, wait a minute, I did not know this was a possibility. I had no clue. You know, I will admit that I have been a dreamer my whole life. And I don't know if that's something you're born with, but I have forever been, you know, someone who likes to think about big picture, right? Stories with vast landscapes and horizon lines. I've always been like that. Now, I am first generation German, and my late father grew up, he was much older, and he grew up living under Nazi Germany. And so, you know, that was a man who threw dreams away because his had been, you know, ripped from him and his family. And so that was a really interesting juxtaposition, right? You had, you know, he had a child that lived in dreams, and yet he lived in a stark reality where dreams were very dangerous, because to dream meant to identify the world around you in very realistic and potentially stark terms. And in doing so can impact your mood, your outlook on life, how you want to tackle it or engage with it. So yeah, I am guilty as charged when it comes to being a dreamer. And it's probably helped me along the way in saying yes to things and saying yes to stories and interviews that on their surface, it would have been an easy pass, right? And you go, okay, not an interesting pitch. And maybe you focus, maybe there were times when I would think, oh, who is this PR rep that sent this? Like, there's nothing interesting you're sharing with me. And I don't know about you, Mike, and the guests that you have, but I have, maybe this means I'm getting older and more crotchety about it. Used to, people would come to me trying to tell me the agenda of what they wanted me to capture. And it's like, okay, well, this feels very inverted. But I would say to them, and I've held true to this day, which is, if I can read something in a press release, I'm not going to talk about it in an interview. To me, that's lazy. And you know, people can scoff at that, but you know, especially now in an AI world where content is being sort of co-opted by algorithms and prompts, why would I focus on things that are really talking points or high level bullet points around, you know, how well your company did or an acquisition? Like, no, I want to know the people behind it. Because to me, that's what's motivating. That's what can be inspiring and or normalizing for people where they say, I had no idea. I had no idea that that individual who I think is several arm lengths away from me in my life is actually much closer. And maybe that gives me a different perspective.
Yeah, I'm curious what you would say, but I feel like every good podcast or every good interview or discussion I've ever listened to, it always comes back to, like, if I ask myself what made that good, it felt authentic and it felt like the people had some kind of connection and they were not hiding behind scripted lines or scripted topics. I do wonder, how do you, as an experienced interviewer, break that? Like, if someone comes to you and says, here are my talking points, you know, only ask me this. And you're like, oh, come on. How do you then break through the barrier? How do you get to the real person?
It's an important question. And I think it's a question that can apply not just for, let's say, media, but for job interviews, performance reviews, difficult conversations with spouses or loved ones. Like, how do you break through knowing that you have to get to a certain destination, or at least that's what has been prescribed or requested or agreed upon at some level? You know, in the very beginning, what I did out of my own anxiety in interviews was to search for people and their personal lives. And it was so interesting to me because I would just maybe do, let's say, a cursory LinkedIn, you know, scan. And I would see maybe that somebody went to, you know, wherever, University of Heidelberg or something like that, or University of Florida here in the States. And I would say something right when they would, you know, be in front of me in person or on a Skype back then or whatever the technology. And I might say something like, you know, go Gators, you know, or, you know, good game last Saturday. And they would immediately drop the wall of sort of perceived distance between themselves and whoever's interviewing them, and they'd be human. I would like to hope that I have refined that over time, but yeah, I would look for one thing. And I remember using it even in business settings. I was going to a meeting with I think she was a head of a school district, and there was like nothing online, but I saw this one thing that I found that she seemed to go to every year, which was, and it's here in Tennessee, and it was, it's called like Mule Day or something like that. Okay. It's a parade of mules and it goes back, you know, generations. And I just found that so interesting because I'm not from the South. And I sat down, and it was the first thing that I mentioned was about Mule Day. And I just remember her thinking, man, that's good. Like, you know, and so then we just had a really great meeting and we ended up collaborating together, and I'm not saying that that sealed it at all. And I was being genuine because I did think it was very interesting, because you have to be genuine. People pick up on if you've, okay, fine, you figured out the names of my kids or where I went to school or a mascot, you know. So it never needs to be like that. But I try to be human. I think the evolution of that has been, how can I be human right out of the gate? So even if I don't have something, let's say your background, if I'm interviewing you, if I can relate to you as a fellow interviewer in a human way, then hopefully we'll connect and that will help us, you know. And so that's become just my, like, just out of the gate. I don't have an agenda. It's just, how can I connect with you? In the book, I talk about this. So not to give it away, but, you know, I had the opportunity to interview Magic Johnson, the Hall of Fame NBA player and just global iconic smile and personality, right? And he's an intimidating guy. And I interviewed him in person in Los Angeles. And I thought, you know, this is one of those times where I thought, what is my first question going to be? How am I going to break through that barrier, as you put it? And I like that. I didn't, you know, you sort of go through and you say, like, that's when you're wrestling with yourself, because you're saying, everything in me says, do what you normally do, because if you go outside of that, that's where problems can sort of jump out at you. And so I did. I just, like, you know, you just hear my voice, but I decided that I'm just going to let it rip. You know, I'm going to, in the moment, the only thing I can say that I have is that we both went to Michigan State, and I know that that will last. That'll give me, you know, a little bit of runway, but it's not going to, I think, extend into this sort of shared journey of story that we're going to now hopefully partake on. So in that moment, I just decided that, you know what, because I'm a huge basketball fan and my Detroit Pistons are, you know, I don't have any tattoos, but if I did, that would be, there'd be some recognition for my Detroit Pistons. And I grew up during the Bad Boy era, for those that are basketball aficionados. And I just went with a human thing, which was that he ripped my heart out in 1988. And I told him, I said, look, I think that was, you have to admit, Magic, that was a phantom foul on Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And he laughed. So we had this great laugh. And there was someone that was a part of the production staff that just was on their cell phone, and they captured the image. And that is, you know, my family framed that for me because it just symbolized, go with your gut. You know, if you're just human, you're going to get a response that is at worst like open, because you revealed your vulnerability. So that's how I've always broken through it. It doesn't sound like it's very prescriptive, and it's not intended to be. But I do know we live in a world where people sort of like to have their 3 steps to breaking through a barrier or 7 steps to becoming a writer. And they watch countless videos on YouTube that go round and round and round. And I am definitely not the guy for that, if that's what people are looking for.
It's funny because I wrote down the question for this interview, which is like, how does the preparation or interview approach change based on like how high profile the person is you're talking to? And it sounds like actually it doesn't change that much. You're still going with the idea of making a human connection. Of course, maybe it's like a video game, like level 100 is like a super famous person, probably has had 50 times like, oh, we went to the same college or something like this. So you're actually, you're giving them the thing that you're connecting on a level that they absolutely did not expect to connect on, which is like a very human level.
I do want to make mention as well, though, that I do, this is sort of the motivator in me when I coach youth sports, that you also want to act like you've been there. You know, I mean, if you have aspirations, if you can thread the needle, be vulnerable, be human, but be professional in a way that says, I've either been here before or I'm going to be back. Right. Because I think a lot of people will, I don't want them to not hear me correctly and thinking, oh, if I'm just vulnerable and I show that I, you know, I don't know exactly what I'm doing. That's not what I'm saying at all. You know, you want to be professional in a way where because in that you give them a different experience. You can be vulnerable. You can be respectful. You can show dignity with the lack of words, with the way in which you face or sit. You know, it's your body language. So it is, I do think there's an art to it, and you'll find different times when you have to deploy it in different ways. When I was in the Middle East and I'm sitting down to interview a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad, I'm taking a very different tact in that interview, right? And knowing that sort of the elephant in the room is his lineage. And so I'm going to do myself a favor and get that out of the way in the beginning, but do so in a deferential way that speaks to him as a man who was a young boy, who understands history. And let's go from there. And then we can talk about his perspectives on current day, right? Now, if I had done that and acted like I couldn't handle the weight of a discussion, it would have fallen apart. This is when I lean back. I know that I do this. I don't do this consciously, but this goes back to my work in getting my doctorate in clinical psych. I mean, you know, you can believe and practice different types of psychology and schools of thought and therapeutic approaches. But really, at the end of the day, if you're sitting there across from a person, they want to know that you can handle metaphorically the anxiety, the challenges, the fears, the hopes and dreams while they sit there so they can breathe. And if they can breathe, maybe they can start to communicate and walk through and detangle what it is that they come to talk about.
Making them see that you see them, actually. Yeah. I mean, actually, again, we're going back to storytelling, right? You're essentially saying, I see your story. I understand your story. And you're connecting to them.
You're 1,000% right. And to me, that is like ding, ding, ding. It's that is it. That is absolutely it. We are humans. At the end of it, regardless of what's on our bank account or how many degrees we have or the clothes that we wear or the people that we're surrounded with, we're humans. We hear it all the time and we get beaten over the head with it through Hollywood movies and fictional stories about the person that, you know, sort of made it to the mountaintop and yet is lonely, depressed, you know, reflective on the relationships they passed by in pursuit of something commercial. So it truly is. And I think that good interviews, good storytellers understand that. Look, there's a rhythm. And that's, I don't know if we'll talk about sort of the writing process. I'm happy to, but that is something that when I talk to writers, they talk about finding voice. Like literary agents, they want to know if they're going to take somebody on or a publisher is going to come to you. They want to know that that you've got a voice. You found your voice. Because if you haven't, it's going to be this sort of hodgepodge of thoughts, of wisdom, hopefully, of trying to be, affable and with humor. And it is not going to mat. It's not going to sort of pull together. So it's super important.
How do you define that? Like, how do you know if you found your voice?
Here's how. I'll go back to the sports analogy. I do think this is for me, of course, because I can't get it sort of into the mind or spirit of somebody else and their creativity. But I do believe in the zone, that this feeling that you have where it's not like, I don't mean it as sort of this adolescent, feeling of I can conquer anything, or, I'm king of the world or queen of the world or whatever it is. But there's this feeling that you have. It's almost like a vibration, like a frequency, that you're in the zone. And for me, it's about rhythm. There's a rhythm to the language. There's a rhythm to what I'm doing. There's a rhythm to the way I'm asking a question and how much time I'm giving that person to sort of walk through their own ideas. And for those wannabe or soon to be, let's say, podcasters, that'd be one piece of advice: that never assume that your guest has basically rehearsed the answers to questions they didn't know were going to be posed to them. It sounds really sort of like I'm being critical in that way, but I do think it's important, because giving people, it's like pouring wine in a decanter. Why do we do that? We let the wine breathe. Let the conversation breathe. It will find its own rhythm. You may not be in music and play an instrument, but truly what we're talking about is jazz, right? It's, I don't know this person, but he's going to come up and play bass, and there's just a look, there's a sound, boom, and we're good to go. And that is really powerful, I think, as humans. And so that is something that I will tell you, that's probably, now I'm getting asked about my second, like what's the second book going to be, those sorts of things. And I think I would imagine any creative goes through this, whether you're a painter or what, doesn't matter, your medium, that can I capture again that zone, right? That feeling that just says the rest of the world has sort of taken a nap so that I could fully sort of realize all these incredible, elements, and then write or paint or whatever that is. So, but man, that is such a great feeling. And for me, it's always a rhythm. It's a rhythm. I'm reading my own stuff going rhythm, that's important to me.
I'm going to come back to this in a moment, because we've been talking about the book a little bit.
Yeah.
I actually want to come back to it, because one of the first things we started in this conversation was talking about saying yes to opportunities when they pop up. Like, you get that email, you open it, you spontaneously feel like this is a yes. Writing a book, on the other hand, doesn't feel like a reactive yes. That feels like a intentional yes. Unless you got an email that said, hey, I'm a publisher, want to write a book and have some money, which I'm going to guess is not how it was.
So I'm going to flip it on you, so what do you think it was? Like, tell me what the assumption is.
I'm hoping you'll correct me. My assumption is something inside of you said, I need to go and write this book. I've had a bunch of experiences and I can feel this is an urge where I need to go.
This has
and,
to
like,
be a book, right? Yeah.
Or something, right? Like, I have this thing in like this, these thought bubbles I need to go write. Maybe that's completely off the mark.
No, I would say this. No, I think it's a very well grounded and educated guess in sort of probably the process for lots of people, that they either tell themselves at some point in my life, I'm going to write a book. And if I don't, I'm going to regret it. Right. I think some people might say that about a triathlon or a marathon or something like that. That's something that they're acknowledging is a mountain that they have to climb, and they are willing. They don't know when, but they're willing to put the work in because they want to matter. They want their experiences to matter for whatever reason. Right. That's important to them. My experience was a little bit different. I had been, I had gotten inbound interest from publishers of different levels. And that's just because, and I knew this, right? This is because I was writing articles with Forbes and Entrepreneur Magazine. And so it was a natural, because we live in a world where marketing is very important, to your earlier point. And so, whether I had a story to tell, they might see potential because of the platform that they believe that I have, right? So I'll give you some inside baseball, as we might say. It was coming to a sort of a crescendo. That's like, I had done so much writing my story. Like, at some point I have got to figure, like, what is my story? It goes back to this Richard Gerber and the TEDx talk. You know, was my story, had it sort of matured enough to now convey through a book? And this is after my TEDx. And so you kind of see it as sort of the next thing you want to summit. And so my target was, my birthday's in September, and I kept saying to myself, I really want to have my idea by my birthday and start basically sending it out. I've got to know, you know, with my network, there has to be some connection somewhere where this can happen. I got really lucky because in like right around that time, I started getting pinged by Wiley. Wiley's been around since like 1807. They're the second largest publisher of business books in the world. Like, they are, you know, they have a seat at the table. And it was a little bit like the Senegal thing, right? I'm getting this email through my website. I'm getting pinged and connected on LinkedIn. I'm getting a follow on Instagram. And I finally thought, okay, this has to be legit. So let me go ahead and take this call. So we get on the phone on a Zoom, and it was on a Thursday and like mid-afternoon my time. And, you know, it was, look, we've been watching you and we think you could do something pretty interesting. And we're very interested in storytelling. And I knew why they were, because half the time Harvard Business Review would get in the mailbox, I'd see it and it would have something about storytelling. And we just see it everywhere. Right now I'm seeing that there are doctoral programs in education that their students are taking courses on storytelling. Right. So and that's probably not the only sector that's doing it. And so that's the reason why I say Thursday afternoon is sometimes you do have to meet the moment, right? Sometimes you have to say yes, and it's not on your timeline, right? The story has advanced in a way that you didn't anticipate. You were still in like act one, scene one, and you're, whoa, we went past intermission here. Because at the end of that discussion, it was told to me that, you know, look, don't know if you could do this, Rod, but on Monday morning, we have our call, international call, and would like to be able to present your book idea to the rest of the leadership. Okay, well, it's Thursday afternoon, so Thursday's gone. I don't have a treatment. I don't have a proposal of any kind. And so I took my Saturday and spent 6 hours and put together a presentation and a book proposal, and they, you know, went well. And so then, you know, lawyers get involved and contracts, and then I had exactly 6 months to be done with the book. So
wow, that's a short time frame.
Yeah. And I you learn so much. I mean, this is where you think to yourself, wow, I'm so much more educated after this first sort of, you know, run of show, that, you know, you get a deadline contractually when you have to turn in your manuscript. And so I met that deadline, and I beat it by a few hours. I did it the night before. I wanted to make sure that it wasn't, you know, and that's just the competitor in me. But it was a fascinating process where, I mean, it's like putting a child in like timeout or something for behavior that is unbecoming, because you have to go into timeout as an adult and sit there and reflect on the life that you've lived, depending upon the story that you're going to tell, right? Obviously, it's book dependent or story dependent, I would say. But in my case, I had to reflect on over 40 years of, you know, potholes and bright horizons and missteps and mistakes and accidental successes and achievements. Got it done. And yeah, so now the pressure is in trying to figure out, you know, what's the response? Because that's the other thing. You become very vulnerable to it. You know, you just don't know. You sort of come out of your timeout. You're in a cave and you hope it is received well. And I've been very, very blessed in that way, in the response that's already come in about the book. So I hope that it does well. And I hope that it does well, not because it just says, oh, you know, this is what Rod Berger did or something like that, because I wanted to provide platform for a new set of stories to highlight, you know, and that, to me, that's the objective. Because if this is received well, this connects with people in different parts of the world, regardless of their backgrounds or their culture, then I have the opportunity to not control, but to steer my character and my own narrative in a way that allows for the next book and the book after that. So that's what's really important to me.
That sounds like you're hooked. after doing one book?
I don't know. I'm so glad. That's a really good point. Am I hooked? Like the hook part. I would say this. I talk about, like, if you're in the Western world and you're returning a car at the airport, oftentimes there are spikes that you cross over with the vehicle, and you know, well, I can't back up now. For me, storytelling is just, in general, forget the medium, whether it's I'm in front of a camera or I'm writing something or I'm behind a microphone, it's so addicting that it truly is returning that car going, the only way is forward. And that may imply then that I'm getting on a plane and going somewhere. And I don't mean literally all the time, though I do travel. It is in its own right very addicting in that way, because it transports you to a world where time takes on a different essence. But yeah, I can't go back. I mean, I am forever wanting to feel that stimulation from other people's experiences and stories, and then finding ways to, I don't know, play a role, you know, play a role. Maybe that's it's an interview, or it's a connection that I make for somebody, or, you know, and then they tell a different story from that. Right. So it is absolutely addicting. And so, yeah, I'm hooked for sure. And I think you gain a bit of confidence too, like anything. Oh, okay. I knew this was in me. And if I just stay true to myself, because this goes back to Senegal, as we are approaching the airport, like literally the landing where you're looking down, you know, kids look out the window. Oh, look, it's so green, or it's so whatever's going on. Right. And I remember as we're descending on our landing, for whatever reason, I had a moment where I basically was mad at myself. And I said, I am tired of writing stories in the manner that people expect or want me to write. Like, I'm done with that. And I did it just on that. And so from that point, whenever I travel, depending upon what the circumstance is, I try to provide daily journals that I put up. I don't do anything official. You know, I just throw it up on Facebook or sometimes on LinkedIn. But I want people to feel like they're there with me. And if I convey it at that level, then that's typically the feedback that I get. And that's, if I hadn't made that decision that moment, this book would never have seen the light of day.
There's this expression that I heard recently, not me, not now. And in the regards to doing stuff that you really want to do in life. And I think I felt this as well. I mentioned before we even started recording that, you know, I've wanted to do a podcast, writing online, like publishing stuff and getting out there in the world. And I feel like for a long time, I was the opposite of you, where it feels like you maybe have learned at a young age to say yes to opportunities. I feel like I was always in the not me, not now bucket, which is, there's always some reason. There's always some part of the story which is like, the market conditions aren't right, or, well, I should focus on my career right now, or I don't know what it is. There's very often, it's very easy to grab one of those not me, not now reasons. And it feels like what you're describing is doing the exact opposite again and again and again, which is listening to that internal gut feeling that says yes and going and doing the thing.
So, I mean, look, I think potentially, for me, maybe that comes from just knowing what I know about my father's story growing up during World War II. Maybe there is that sense of desperation that if I don't say yes, that yes may not come around tomorrow. So that very easily could be the preamble to a story that evolves and unfurls into a world of just saying yes. That very likely could be what did it. I've not heard that phrase, that not me, not now, but I'm gonna use that. I like that. It's interesting because, as you said, that I was thinking about deterrence, like things that deter us from putting ourselves out there, right? And again, that's just it's a cute way of saying that we fear failure, that we and it's not even failure. I think it's more about acknowledgement, or that our efforts will go, you know, it's the tree that falls in the forest and nobody you don't hear it. And that has real implications, I think, for people, because if I'm a tree and I fall right in the forest and nobody hears it, man, if I'm even just the slightest bit reflective and introspective, that could take me down a very sort of, I think, dark hole, because it makes me think, you know, in essence, why am I not remembered? Why do people not think about me? And it's interesting. This is one of the things, not to go back to psychology, but I remember through my training and clinical experiences that, you know, it was so interesting. Maybe there'd be a patient that would come in, or someone that you'd work with regularly. And if I remember in the beginning, there was one where I remember saying something like, oh, you know, it'd be like, Mike, I was at this store the other day and I thought about you. The fact that I would say to you audibly that I thought about you, regardless of what in the world it was, it could have been that you always wear sort of the color black, and I saw all these things, like it was about outfits in black. There's no real substance to it, right? It didn't even matter. The fact that I had said I had thought about you when you were not present, like, it does something, right? It like lights up the brain in a way that says, wow, you know, I have value. And so I think that that is, I just think that's really important, you know, and that's why I like to say yes in so many ways, because I get so much more. People will think, oh, that, you know, you help that individual. It's like, no, I remember years ago I had interviewed a teacher in a small town in like the state of Kansas. And it was like months later, I'm at a conference and I get like a tug at my jacket, like almost like a little kid would do, you know, like, hey, dad, can we go, you know, buy something? And I look and it's this woman. And at first I didn't recognize her. And I quickly did. She was that teacher. Well, that interview somehow got picked up by their like local NBC affiliate. And she became, then she was brought up like in front of her congregation at church because of it. And she ended up getting funding for this project for the school. And, you know, I think that did more for me than it even did for her or for her students, because I just, again, I had said yes to something that on the surface, it would have been like, oh, I don't have time for that. But it made a difference. It made a difference. And the, boy, that feels good. That fills my own bucket up.
So it's like, it's two things. One is, it reminds me of this image. I don't know if you've seen it. There's probably similar images. It's like a decision tree. It kind of says, this is your life. And it has many lines. And then there's like a line in the middle dividing the picture. And it's like, it's showing that if you say yes to one decision, there are like an infinite amount of trees opening from that yes. And if you would say no, then it's a hard stop, basically, right? Like,
yeah.
This is something I think about sometimes when I'm also thinking like, should I do the thing? And it feels like almost always yes is the right answer, because you're opening up another branch of like infinite possibilities.
Absolutely. And especially if you are, if you hold yourself to being authentic to who you are, like my North Star shouldn't be to be like Mike. That's also a very famous line in commercials for Michael Jordan here in the US years ago. Be like Mike. But mine should be about like where I'm good at, right? I mean, I think that that's the thing. If my North Star is based on what I'm naturally good at, then I have a chance, I think, to succeed. But if I'm trying to be something that's not me, just because that's not my personality, it's not going to go well. I'll give you an example. So I was 16 when I started public speaking. I had a teacher who, you know, sort of saw something in me and said, you know, I think you should join this nonprofit. And then, okay, I'll do that. And then he said, you know, I think you ought to put together something where you could present in front of other schools. Okay, I'll do that. And he sort of kept pushing me. And then he one day said, oh, I signed you up for this national competition. Okay, I'll do that. And then I won that, which was great. And I, you know, I'm 17 and I was getting paid to go around to schools around the country to speak to communities and schools. And you become a little full of yourself, I think, because you're a teenager and as terrified as you are because you're talking to your peers. And there was one instance where I chose to go a different route and I was not myself. Now, was I, you know, all the basics, right? I was on stage, I was speaking, you know, check, check, check all the boxes. But the way that I did it was the way somebody else would do it, which meant it wasn't authentic, which meant that the audience could pick up on it, even if they couldn't sort of audibly say, you know, what they're seeing or consciously, you know, aware of what it is that's not, that's off. And it is by far one of the top three worst professional experiences I've ever had, but probably one of the most consequential. Because when the moment before Magic Johnson, I'm thinking about that and I'm in the heat of it, because moments before I even said hello to him, an audio guy just immediately rushed up to mic him up. And you don't do that to people like Magic Johnson. You wait till they're red. Like you there's some deference that, but this was a young guy. He didn't know, you know, he didn't have any ill intent. And I was sort of in the fire going, wow, this is not starting the way I want. Cause now you've made Magic a little bit irritated, which I would be too. And man, just be yourself. I remember telling myself, and I thought about that time on stage. So for me, it's about, yeah, I mean, one, yeah, you should do it, you and the mics out there, but just do it in the way that you know that you are, that you can connect. Like, how do people in your own life, I would say to people, like, well, how do people connect with you as it is? What is it about your personality? You know, you're either you're gregarious or you're the, they got to have the one fun person in the group, or you're the reflective one, or the, you know, you're the deep one, you know, you're the serious one. These are all important roles in the very sort of larger story. But being honest, I think, and authentic to what we can do and the talent that we have during this lifetime will help to accelerate that.
Until now, I feel like I would have said to make a good connection with someone quickly, or to have a good interview, for example, part of that process feels a bit like being a chameleon in a way, because you're, and I think I'm doing this wrong for the record. Like, this is something that I've tried to, you know, work on as a person. I've always felt like my default reaction in a situation with a new person is to be a chameleon. So I see what they're putting out, and I start mirroring that energy. I start mirroring that personality. And that is the opposite of an authentic connection. So, I mean, like, somehow it's counterintuitive to me, but also makes complete sense what you're saying, which is like what you actually are supposed to do is follow your own North Star. So be authentic to yourself, but still find something which you can connect with the other person.
Like, yeah, and push through that, right? I would have never been accused of being sort of the class clown or the one that could just, you know, that wouldn't have been me. I'm much more, I definitely can be more serious, more wanting to live sort of in the deeper waters. And so I think that's part of like when I was landing in Senegal, right? It was like, okay, that's who I am. So I'm going to lean into that. I'm going to write stories. I'm going to document stories at that level. Like, that's what I want to get to. Because if I can get to that, it'll show up differently, right? It's like when I interviewed Sammy Hagar of Van Halen. We didn't talk about music and what people might think. You know, we talked about how he grew up incredibly poor in the lettuce fields of Salinas, California, and how his grandfather lived in a trailer on the land. And even though they didn't have money, the grandfather would cook like he was an Italian chef. And a young Sammy Hagar could walk towards his grandfather's trailer and smell the sort of waft of food and culture, right? And the pride that he had for his grandfather. It had nothing to do with music. I'm just saying that to say I could have done what I think most people would have wanted to do when you speak to someone who's like, Sammy Hagar, Van Halen, I need to be cool. You know, I need to, do I have a leather jacket? Like, I don't know, like what... What makes me cool? I got to match their energy or maybe the people that love him, right? No, it's like, I'm going to do me. If I do it really well, great. And the result of that was he had said that he hadn't had an interview like that in years. Man, that hit. It wasn't about, I did a great job or anything like that. It was that we connected in a way that he shared stories that he doesn't normally share. And okay, now I've provided a unique value and found the essence of him.
And also a way more unique interview and a way more unique outcome than the 25 interviewers that came before and tried to do exactly the same thing every single time.
I hope you're right.
What was that landing moment? You referenced it a couple times, like you're landing in that plane to Senegal. You said yes to the email, you're there, you're landing. Like, what about that moment? What clicked for you?
You know, it was my first time to Africa and it felt like I couldn't believe how lucky I was that I was going. Because leading up to that, and it was a very short sort of runway, literally, figuratively, to when I found out I was going to be going and when I went, I was very aware that this was a very unique experience. This was not just flying up to Cleveland or flying out to LA where I used to live. This was very different. And I really, really wanted to desperately be very aware. I wanted all of my senses open and ready. And I think that that was a huge part of it. Yeah, I think the choice is you could go to a place like that and say, I'm just there to document, to basically collect information. That's all well and good. I don't know, though. I've always been, you know, even if I'm sort of quote unquote collecting information for, let's say, a story, I'm bullish on, I think the reader or the audience, they kind of want to know what it's like in that environment. Yeah, they want to learn what you've sort of, you know, found from a data perspective or whatever the information is you're going to be documenting, but they want to know, what is it, you know, what does it feel like? What is the air taste like? You know, what is it like to be in these different environments that most people will not go? And so that's also the benefit of being able to travel in ways where I'm not a tourist. And in fact, it actually impacts my ability now as a tourist because I can feel it when I'm doing stuff that's touristy, right? Because I'm with my family or something like that. But when I'm alone, that's, you know, it allows me to be sort of fully present. So I think my desire when that plane was landing was really sort of, you know, my own motivational sort of coach speak, which was like, don't mess this up. If this is the only time you come to the continent, make it as, you know, the most amazing experience you can.
It was awareness and an appreciation of like, I'm here, I am present for this.
Yeah. Absolutely. Like I wanted all of it. I wanted to know, no, because it's a great example. It's not just Africa, but I think just regardless of where your home of origin is, there are all these biases and sort of unfounded fears about distant lands and cultures that are unlike our own. And so whether it was, you know, me getting my vaccinations to go to Africa and that doctor who was a very seasoned physician saying to me, why are you going? You know, like there's some, like the whole continent, like there, you know, there are fears out there, I think. And it's really based on nothing other than something being unknown. And am I going to find something that I can relate to when I land that will make me feel comfortable enough to be able to participate without cowering to anxiety, right? You want to be so present in those moments to be able to connect the dots in a way that I think is authentic. And so that's just a huge driver for me. Even now, even if I'm not going to Africa, I'm going somewhere else. I want to be able to do that, to communicate that. It's like when I head to Stockholm towards the end of the summer. It's the same kind of thing. I want those experiences, those connections, in a way where I can be my own, be myself.
I think there's a real joy to being present. I think it's like the opposite of anxiety as well, right? It's like getting out of your head and just being fully in the moment is one of the best things you can ever do. It's not always easy.
It's not always easy. And it's one of the reasons I think pre-pandemic why so many people loved going to the movie theater. Like, you were forced. That Dolby surround system or whatever the sound, you know, like you were forced to say, for the next 2 hours, I can think of nothing other than what is in front of me. And that is something that we don't get all the time. We're so fragmented in our ability. It's like Daniel Pink, who I interviewed years ago, is a very kind man. We exchange emails like once a year, kind of a thing. I always thought very highly of him. And then, you know why? Because of the way he treated me in person when I interviewed him in Los Angeles. He talks about that we are stimulus rich and context poor. And I could not agree more with that. And I think that's one of the challenges, and why when I was landing in Africa, in Senegal, in Western Africa, why I wanted to feel like I was in a movie theater that lasted 2 weeks.
It's against storytelling. I mean, in right. a way, I heard this quote from Hank Green, which is, storytelling is everything. And the more we talk about it, the more I connect with that.
I couldn't agree more.
Do you think storytelling is changing as well? To be honest, when I asked you, like, why write this book now, the secret question in my mind is because I was wondering if it came from some... I've spoken to a few people who wrote books, and it came from a sense of urgency. Like, something is happening in the world right now that I need to write this now. And when I thought of storytelling, and of course AI is a topic, I wondered, was there also a feeling of like, it's changing, like storytelling is changing, something is changing?
My gut reaction is no, it wasn't written from that platform, though you could easily apply it to that, right? You could affix it to a world where we are advancing so much, so where words are not our own anymore. But it also, that matches for me just in the way that I've always written in general, which is, you know, we talk about evergreen content, just meaning that it can last. It's not time stamped. That's how I've done. I mean, 95% of my interviews and stories have all been around being evergreen as possible. Because if I do that, then it changes the focus and format and the way in the conversation that we'll have, because we're not beholden to a product release date or a tour date or a book launch. You know, it's like, okay, we can just talk about things that span that person's lifetime, and it's all on the table.
I see. So you're intentionally keeping it evergreen in the sense that you don't want to connect it too much to like whatever's happening in that moment.
Yeah, because to me, then you have something that automatically puts itself, at least as a content piece, as if it were a living, breathing thing, in position to rise above, or at least be in a different room than all the other content related to that person or topic that is often time-stamped or time-dependent. Now, the inverse of that is when I'm editor-at-large for an international publication called Fair Observer, and the writers for Fair Observer are like former MI6 and CIA, and they've had prime ministers write. So it's a very heady group. And so when I do interviews for them, it puts me in a different frame, because sometimes we're talking about, you know, we're talking about world events, right? And their reflection. So there's definitely an art and science in figuring out how to talk about something that's current while not making it the main character, so that we can learn more about all the different elements that have led up to that individual's sort of life perspective and analysis on something potentially that is current. So, and I took that because of that very reason, because it would push me to think about my questions in a very different way with a group that is very well prepared verbally to be able to spar with. So that's been a good experience, because it's flipped that notion of sort of that evergreen content in a way where I've had to be creative and mindful of it in a way that has hopefully evolved my storytelling.
It sounds like it makes you go a little bit deeper, right? Because you cannot just, it can be a little bit lazy to just feel like I did, right? Oh, AI is a topic. What do you think about that? Like in a way, you're actually going deeper than that and trying to get to the real core of the story or of that person that you're talking to.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't, one, don't be so hard on yourself, but I would say...
I'm British. I have to be.
You have to be. It's in the blood. I think that it's also, you know, look, this is, Aaron Rasmussen, he's the co-founder of Masterclass and someone that I think is an incredible storyteller. Interviewed him on a number of occasions, and he made one comment to me once where he talked about how, you know, he said most people see a line, like a line that you wouldn't cross, right, into conversation. Most people see a line and they don't really go up to it. They sort of recognize it and they stay with it at a safe distance or a perceived safe distance. And he was talking about me, and he said, you see that line, you walk to that line, you cross over it, and you extend a hand and bring your guest or that person across the line on the other side. And that was really, if people say, well, like, what's the greatest compliment? Like, that for me is one that absolutely is at the top, because it's so multifaceted for me. It's that I'm living in the current with somebody. I'm committing energy to understanding sort of where they're at. You know, it's not about always, this is nothing. Nothing is a gotcha or like, hey, reveal a secret. That's not it at all. It's just really curious about and honoring the life that person has led or has lived up until that time. And so I think the more you do that, the more comfortable you are in sort of peering around dark corners, not knowing where it's going to take you. And that if you do it, I think from an authentic place, one, people can pick up on that. They know it's not coming from like, I'm just prodding or prying, and they're more willing to share perspective and anecdotes that maybe they don't often put words to. And I think that can be really revealing for people, because we're all trying to learn from one another, whether we say that overtly or not. And so that's been a powerful approach for me, to be able to do that, to sort of cross that transom and not fear it and just say, okay. Now, of course, my training did a lot of that in psychology, because the hardest or most difficult question for those that are climbing the ranks in psychology is having the awareness of someone in front of you who has suicidal ideation and being able to ask them honestly if they have a plan. Because the general public would never ask somebody that. They would think, oh, I'm really worried about Mike. You know, he seems like he's been down. He doesn't seem to have a lot of resources. How do we help him? But you have to be able to ask that question if you're going to help that individual. When you have to do that in real life, and I've done that, it does change, I think, your DNA a little bit. Because it's like, okay, if I can ask that and do so from a position of care and want to support and find an open door to a world that feels closed off for that individual, then I can ask you about why you chose the path that you did, you know, or that epic mistake that was across the, you know, all the headlines, right? So it's all relative.
I imagine. Once you've learned to be comfortable going that deep and asking that kind of question, coaching is in no way close to clinical psychology, but I do feel going through coaching training as well, there was a few moments there where it felt like the main thing that most people, including myself, had to learn was being comfortable being uncomfortable, because the deeper you go with people, of course, and if you have trust, you can go deeper. And as you go deeper, more things come up, and there's a tendency to almost want to pull back from it or slip into the drama triangle and be a rescuer or say, hey, no, don't worry, it's okay. And actually, what's more powerful is staying eye to eye and being okay with that, right? Just staying with the discomfort and being okay with it, and then going deeper into the conversation and being okay with that. And it sounds, I don't know if that sounds easy or not, but it's not.
No, I'm with you. I'm tracking. I wish more people would think like that. I think we all have it in us, you know, and I'm hoping that the book, you know, helps to support that for people in that way. But it's absolutely been an honor to be able to be in the presence of people and the trust that they've extended to me to capture their story in ways that maybe haven't done before. I take with great deference for their trust in me and just the respect and dignity that I hope I can give to their stories. So full circle, you know?
Definitely full circle. When is the book coming out? Also, I think a good time to plug as well. How can people get their hands on it?
So you can pre-order the book, The Narrative Edge, Authentic Storytelling That Meets the Moment, wherever books are sold. You can go to my website, which is just drrodberger.com. You can /book if you want, but it's also on the homepage. And you can click on wherever books are sold. All the different buttons are there. It hits bookstores November 12th. I will say, I know we're wrapping things up here, but I will say that for those that pre-order, I will be then sending those folks a lost chapter. Now, you never know, Mike, you might be a part of that lost chapter. So we'll just leave that as sort of a teaser, right? But I do appreciate the support. I'm learning a lot about the marketing of books, even though I have a great partner in Wiley that's obviously been around for quite some time. But it's an effort, right? It's raising a baby to a toddler and a toddler to a young child, school age, and going on from there. So it's a lot of work. I do appreciate it, and just know that it hopefully will push me to be able to capture more stories for, you know, forthcoming books as well. So.
Yeah, amazing. And congratulations. I do think it's so cool. Like, everyone I speak to who's written a book says it was super hard. It was very intense. You know, I had to somehow shut myself off from the world, and yet they would absolutely do it again. And they're so happy that they've done the thing, you know, like it feels like such a weird, rewarding experience. Weird because it's so intense and you don't know what's going to happen. And yet, you know, you would do it all again.
That's exactly right.
So I know we're talking about your book. I always ask my guest at the end if there's another resource book, movie, whatever you want, anything that you'd recommend to the people out there.
Oh, you know, I know that I'm really bad when it comes to sort of isolated recommendations. I would say that the way that I look at that is I find one thing that I enjoy, whether it's someone that I'm reading or that I'm watching or sort of studying, because I like to study people just even audibly, how they their turn of phrase, the way they interact with guests, those sorts of things I'll nerd out on. Here's my advice to that. If you find somebody that you connect with, that you learn a lot from, dive deeper with that learning with that individual. If that means reading more of their books or, you know, being a part of a book club or whatever it is, I think too many people, they kind of sample here. Everybody's sampling 1,000 things. They don't realize, well, wait a minute. They really connected with that initial resource and they didn't dive into that and find out, well, okay, how do I fit into this given my personality, my talents, what I bring to the table, my history, all of that. And so they just sample all over the place thinking that that's going to give them some unofficial or artificial degree in that area. I like to take a deep dive. And if I find that I really like the way somebody challenges me in their thinking, then I follow them and I listen to all their different podcast shows because I'm trying to take different things from what they say. And sometimes it's just by osmosis. I'm not sitting with a notepad, but I'm getting immersed in a world where I know it's going to spill over into my own world. And so for me, it's, you know, I don't have an elixir, you know, I mean, hopefully, I mean, maybe that's the wrong thing to say as an author. You want people to then say your book is the one book, right? But I think it's about sort of immersing yourself because that will allow you to learn more, right? So if Brené Brown is your, you know, your muse, then read everything about her and dive into it from that perspective. So that's just kind of how I approach it.
That's cool. It's a bit like mini mentorship in a way. Like, the advantage of there being lots of podcasts and stuff like this is that you can actually just, I can go search Dr. Rudberger on Spotify. I can find everything you've been on and I can just, like, you know, I like this guy. I like the vibe of this person's content. You know, you can just go and basically consume everything. And then you have kind of gained your own mini mentorship with that person. I think that's a cool way sometimes.
It's true. It's true.
And the other question, I think we've kind of gone full circle a few times, but I wonder if there's one key takeaway you'd like to leave everyone with at the end.
I mean, I think the key takeaway I would like for people to think about is just that notion of, if you're not telling your story, who is? And it's not about passing judgment. And it's not that this is a linear thought or process. It's just about asking yourself that question. And it could be something that's incredibly layered, like an onion. It could be that, you know, my voice is represented authentically at home, but for some reason it's not at work, or it's not with my kids, or it is with my kids, but it's not with my spouse, or it is with my roommate, but it's not with my, you know, my suite mates, or whatever the case may be. I think that it helps us think more deeply about the environments that nurture us, that fulfill us and provide us platform and opportunity to excel in the areas that we are exceptionally good at and to get feedback in the same way, right? So it's really that. It's, if you're not writing your story, who is? Because somebody is. And at some point you're going to have to grab sort of the narrative threads and do something about it. And people do that through divorce, through career changes, through moves. They do all kinds of things. But if you start asking yourself that question now as opposed to later, I think that you'll find you can start to recognize patterns of your own behavior, the way in which you think about your story, if it has value. And if it doesn't, why doesn't it have value, right? Because there's some ownership in that, I think, that we have to take responsibility for and acknowledge all the good, the bad, the indifferent, and the ugly that has gotten us to this point, you know?
Face the truth head on.
See, that's nice job, Mike. I agree.
Brad, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. I have a lot to think about now.
Thank you, Mike. I really appreciate it.
And that's a wrap for today's episode. Thanks so much for listening. As always, if you want more information, check the show notes. And if you want to get some creative tips, resources, and news in your inbox, go to imperfect.email and sign up to the Imperfect Creatives newsletter. It goes out every Friday. And I think that's a nice way to end the week. And yes, I'm a little bit biased. And that's it. I'll see you for the next one soon.